It wasn't fast going through the streets with the crew. To them, the world was a permanent theatre, art gallery, music hall, restaurant and spittoon. And in any case, no member of the crew would dream of going anywhere in a straight line. The poodle Trixie Belle accompanied them, keeping as close to the centre of the group as possible. Of Deep Bone there was no sign. William had offered to carry Waffles, because, in a way, he felt he owned him. $100 worth of him, at least. It was $100 he hadn't got, but, well, surely tomorrow's edition would pay for that. And anyone after the dog now surely wouldn't try anything out here on a street in broad daylight, especially since it was barely narrow daylight now. Clouds filled the sky like old eiderdowns. The fog that was descending was meeting the river mist coming up, and the light was draining out of everything. He tried to think of the headline. He couldn't quite get a grip on it yet. There was too much to say, and he wasn't good at getting the huge complexities of the world into fewer than half a dozen words. Saccharissa was better at it, because she treated words as lumps of letters that could be hammered together any old how. Her best one had been on some tedious inter-guild squabble, and in single column read, "Probe into Shock Guild Rumpus." William just wasn't used to the idea of evaluating words purely in terms of their length, whereas she'd picked up the habit in 2 days. He'd already had to stop her calling Lord Veterinari City Boss. It was technically correct that if you spent some time with a thesaurus, you could arrive at that description, and it did fit in a single column, but the sight of the words had made William feel extremely exposed. It was self-absorption like this that allowed him to walk into the printing shed with the crew tagging along and not notice anything wrong until he saw the expression on the faces of the dwarfs. "Ah, our writer man," said Mr. Pin, stepping forward. "Shut the door, Mr. Tulip." Mr. Tulip slammed the door with one hand. The other was clamped over Saccharissa's mouth. She rolled her eyes at William. "And you've brought me the little doggie," said Mr. Pin. Waffles started to growl as he approached. William backed away. "The watch will be here soon," said William. Waffles still growled on a rising note. "Doesn't worry me now," said Mr. Pin. "Not with what I know. Not with who I know. Where's the damn vampire?" "I don't know. He's not always with us," snapped William. "Really? In that case, let me retort," said Mr. Pin, his pistol bow inches from William's face. "If it doesn't arrive within 2 minutes, I will..." Waffles leapt out of William's arms. His bark was the frantic whir-whir of a small dog mad with fury. Pin reared back, one arm raised to protect his face. The bow fired. The arrow hit one of the lamps over the press. The lamp exploded. A cloud of burning oil rained down. It spattered across type metal and old rocking horses and dwarfs. Mr. Tulip let go of Saccharissa to help his colleague, and in the slow dance of rushing events, Saccharissa spun round and planted her knee hard and firmly in the place that made a parsnip a very funny thing indeed. William grabbed her on the way past and rushed her out into the freezing air. When he fought his way back in through the stampeding crew, who had the same instinctive reaction to fire as they did to soap and water, it was into a room full of burning debris. Dwarfs were fighting fires in the rubbish. Dwarfs were fighting fires in their beards. Several were advancing on Mr. Tulip, who was on his hands and knees and throwing up. And Mr. Pin was spinning around, flailing at an enraged Waffles, who was managing to growl while sinking his teeth into Pin's arm all the way to the bone. William cupped his hands. "Get out right now!" he yelled. "The tins!" One or two dwarfs heard him and looked around at the shelves of old paint tins just as the first one blew off its lid. The tins were ancient, no more now than rust held together with chemical sludge. Several others were starting to burn. Mr. Pin danced across the floor, trying to shake the enraged dog from his arm. "Get the damn thing off of me!" he yelled. "Forget that ing dog! My ing suit's on fire!" shouted Mr. Tulip, flailing at his own sleeve. A tin of what had once been enamel paint took off from the blazing mess, spinning with a zip-zip noise, and exploded on the press. William grabbed Goodmountain's shoulder. "I said, come on! My press, it's on fire! Better it than us! Come on!" It was said of the dwarfs that they cared more about things like iron and gold than they did about people, because there was only a limited supply of iron and gold in the world, whereas there seemed to be more and more people everywhere you looked. It was said mostly by people like Mr. Windling. But they did care fiercely about things. Without things, people were just bright animals. The printers clustered around the doorway, axes at the ready. Choking brown smoke billowed out. Flames licked out among the roof eaves. Several sections of tin roof buckled and collapsed. As they did so, a smouldering ball rocketed out through the door, and three dwarfs who took a swipe only just missed hitting one another. It was Waffles. Patches of fur were still smoking, but his eyes gleamed, and he was still whining and growling. He let William pick him up. He had a triumphant air about him, and turned to watch the burning doorway with his ears cocked.
"That must be it, then," said Saccharissa.
"They might have got out of the back door," said Good Mountain. "Bodney, some of you go round and check, will you?"
"Plucky dog, this," said William.
"Brave
would be better," said Saccharissa, distantly. "It's only five letters. It would look better in a single column sidebar. No, plucky would work, because then we'd get plucky dog puts bite on villains. Although that first line is a bit shy."
"I wish I could think in headlines," said William, shivering.
It was cool and damp down here in the cellar. Mr. Pin dragged himself to a corner and slapped at the burns on his suit.
"We're being trapped," moaned Tulip.
"Yeah, this is stone," said Pin. "Stone floor, stone walls, stone ceiling. Stone doesn't burn, okay? We just stay nice and calm down here and wait it out."
Mr. Tulip listened to the sound of the fire above them. Red and yellow light danced on the floor under the cellar hatchway.
"I don't ing like it," he said.
"We've seen worse."
"I don't ing like it."
"Just keep cool. We're going to get out of this. I wasn't born to fry."
The flames roared around the press. A few late paint tins pinwheeled through the heat, spraying burning droplets. The fire was yellow-white at the heart, and now it crackled around the metal forms that held the type. Silver beads appeared around the leaden, inky slugs. Letters shifted, settled, ran together. For a moment, the words themselves floated on the melting metal, innocent words like thee and truth and shall make ye fear, and then they were lost. From the red-hot press and the wooden boxes and amongst the racks and racks of type, and even out of the piles of carefully stockpiled metal, thin streams began to flow. They met and merged and spread. Soon the floor was a moving, rippling mirror in which the orange and yellow flames danced upside down. On Otto's workbench, the salamanders detected the heat. They liked heat. Their ancestors had evolved in volcanoes. They woke up and began to purr. Mr. Tulip, walking up and down the cellar like a trapped animal, picked up one of the cages and glared at the creatures.
"What are these ing things?" he said,
and dropped it back on the bench. Then he noticed the dark jar next to it.
"And why is it ing got and all viz care on this one?"
The eels were already edgy. They could detect heat too, and they were creatures of deep caves and buried icy streams. There was a flash of dark as they protested. Most of it went straight through the brain of Mr. Tulip. But such as was left of that ragged organ had survived his every attempt at scrambling, and in any case, Mr. Tulip didn't use it much, because it hurt such a lot. But there was a brief remembrance of snow and fir woods and burning buildings and the church. They'd sheltered there. He'd been small. He remembered big shining paintings, more colours than he'd ever seen before. He blinked and dropped the jar. It shattered on the floor. There was another burst of dark from the eels. They wriggled desperately out of the wreckage and slithered along the edge of the wall, squeezing into the cracks between the stones. Mr. Tulip turned at a sound behind him. His colleague had collapsed to his knees and was clutching at his head.
"You're right."
"They're right behind me,"
Pin whispered.
"Nah, just you and me down here, old friend."
Mr. Tulip patted Mr. Pin on the shoulder. The veins on his forehead stood out with the effort of thinking something to do next. The memory had gone. Young Tulip had learned how to edit memories. What Mr. Pin needed, he decided, was to remember the good times.
"Aye, remember when Gerart the Boot and his lads had us cornered in that ing cellar in Quirm?" he said. "Remember what we did to him afterwards?"
"Yes," said Mr. Pin, staring at the blank wall. "I remember."
and that time with that old man who was in that house in Genoa, and we didn't ing know, so we nailed up the door and...
Shut up! Shut up!
Just trying to look on the ing bright side.
We shouldn't have killed all those people, Mr. Pin whispered, almost to himself.
Why not?
Said Mr. Tulip. But Pin's nervousness had got through to him again. He pulled at the leather cord around his neck and felt the reassuring lump on the end. A potato can be a great help in times of trial. A pattering behind him made him turn round, and he brightened up.
Anyway, we're okay now, he said. Looks like it's ing raining.
Silver droplets were pouring through the cellar hatch.
That's not water, screamed Pin, standing up.
The drops ran together, became a steady stream. It splashed oddly and mounded up under the hatch, but more liquid poured on top of it and spread out across the floor. Pin and Tulip backed against the far wall.
That's hot lead, said Pin. They print their paper with it.
How ing much is there going to be?
Down here? Can't end up more than a couple of inches, can it?
At the other side of the cellar, Otto's bench started to smoulder as the pool touched it.
We need something to stand on, said Pin. Just while it cools. It won't take long in this chill.
Yeah, but there's nothing here but us. We're entrapped.
Mr. Pin put his hand over his eyes for a moment and took a deep breath of air that was already getting very warm in the soft silver rain. He opened his eyes again. Mr. Tulip was watching him obediently. Mr. Pin was the thinker.
I've got a plan, he said.
Yeah, good, right.
My plans are pretty good, right?
Yeah, you come up with some ing wonders, I've always said, like when you said we should twist the...
And I'm always thinking about the good of the firm, right?
Yeah, sure, right.
So, this plan, it's not like a perfect plan, but... Oh, the hell with it. Give me your potato.
What?
Suddenly Mr. Pin's arm was stretched out, his crossbow an inch from Mr. Tulip's neck.
No time to argue. Give me the damn potato right now. This is no time for you to think.
Uncertain, but trusting as ever in Mr. Pin's survival abilities in a tight corner, Mr. Tulip pulled the thong of the potato over his head and handed it to Mr. Pin.
Right, said Mr. Pin, one side of his face beginning to twitch. The way I see it...
You better hurry, said Mr. Tulip. It's only a couple of inches away.
The way I see it, I'm a small man, Mr. Tulip. You couldn't stand on me. I wouldn't do. You're a big man, Mr. Tulip. I wouldn't want to see you suffer.
And he pulled the trigger. It was a good shot.
Sorry, he whispered as the lead splashed. Sorry. I'm sorry. Sorry. But I wasn't born to fry.
Mr. Tulip opened his eyes. There was darkness around him, but with a suggestion of stars overhead behind an overcast sky. The air was still, but there was distant soughing, as of wind in dead trees. He waited a while to see if anything would happen, and then said,
"Anyone in there?" "Just me, Mr. Tulip."
Some of the darkness opened its eyes, and two blue glows looked down at him.
"The ing bastard stole my potato. Are you ing death?" "Just death will suffice, I think. Who were you expecting?"
"Eh? For what?"
"To claim you as one of theirs."
"Don't I really? I never ing thought."
"You never speculated?"
"All I know is you've got to have your potato, and then it will be all right."
Mr. Tulip parroted the sentence without thinking, but it was coming back now in the total recall of the dead, from a vantage point of 2 feet off the ground and 3 years of age. Old men mumbling, old women weeping, shafts of light through holy windows, the sound of wind under the doors and every ear straining to hear the soldiers. Us or theirs didn't matter when a war had gone on this long. Death gave the shade of Mr. Tulip a long, cool stare.
"And that's it?"
"Right.
You didn't think there were any bits you might have missed?"
The sound of wind under the doors, the smell of the oil lamps, the fresh, acid smell of snow blowing in through the...
"And if I'm sorry for everything," he mumbled.
He was lost in a world of darkness, without a potato to his name. Candlesticks. They'd been made of gold, hundreds of years ago. There were only ever potatoes to eat, grubbed up from under the snow, but the candlesticks were of gold. And some old woman, she'd said, "It will turn out right if you've got a potato."
"Was any god of some sort mentioned to you at any point?"
"No."
"Damn. I wish they didn't leave me to deal with this sort of thing," Death sighed. "You believe, but you don't believe in anything."
Mr. Tulip stood with his head bowed. More memories were trickling back now, like blood under a closed door, and the knob was rattling, and the lock had failed. Death nodded at him.
"At least you still have your potato, I see."
Mr. Tulip's hand flew to his neck. There was something wizened and hard there on the end of a string. It had a ghostly shimmer to it.
"I thought he got it,"
he said, his face alight with hope.
"Ah, well, you never know when a potato might turn up."
"So it's all going to be all right?"
"What do you think?"
Mr. Tulip swallowed. Lies did not survive long out here, and more recent memories were squeezing under the door now, bloody and vengeful.
"I think it's going to take more than a potato," he said.
"Are you sorry for everything?"
More unused bits of Mr. Tulip's brain, which had shut down long ago, or had never even opened up, came into play.
"How will I know?" he said.
Death waved a hand through the air. Along the arc described by the bony fingers appeared a line of hourglasses.
"I understand you are a connoisseur, Mr. Tulip. In a small way, so am I."
Death selected one of the glasses and held it up. Images appeared around it, bright but insubstantial as shadow.
"What are they?" said Tulip.
"Lives, Mr. Tulip. Just lives. Not all masterpieces, obviously. Often rather naïve in their use of emotion and action. But nevertheless, full of interest and surprise, and each in their own way a work of some genius, and certainly very collectible."
Death picked up an hourglass as Mr. Tulip tried to back away.
"Yes, collectible. Because if I had to find a way to describe these lives, Mr. Tulip, that word would be shorter."
Death selected another hourglass.
"Ah, Nagar Velsky. You will not remember him, of course. He was simply a man who walked into his rather simple little hut at the wrong time. And you are a busy man, and cannot be expected to remember everyone. Note the mind. A brilliant mind that might, in other circumstances, have changed the world. Doomed to be born into a time and place where life was nothing but a daily hopeless struggle. Nevertheless, in his tiny village, right up until the day he found you stealing his coat, he did his best to—"
Mr. Tulip raised a trembling hand.
"Is this the bit where my whole life passes in front of my eyes?" he said.
"No, that was the bit just now."
"Which bit?"
"The bit," said Death, "between your being born and your dying. No, this, Mr. Tulip, this is your whole life as it passed before other people's eyes."
By the time the golems arrived, it was all over. The fire had been fierce but short-lived. It had stopped because there wasn't anything left to burn. The crowd that always turns up to watch a fire then dispersed until the next one, reckoning that this one had not scored very highly, what with no one dying. The walls were still standing. Half the tin roof had fallen in. Sleet had begun to fall too, and now it hissed on the hot stone as William picked his way cautiously through the debris. The press was visible in the light of the few fires still smouldering. William heard it sizzling under the sleet.
"Repairable," he said to Good Mountain, who was following him.
"Not a chance. The frame, maybe, will salvage what we can."
"Look, I'm so sorry."
"Not your fault," said the dwarf, kicking at a smoking can. "And look on the bright side. We still owe Harry King a lot of money."
"Don't remind me."
I don't need to. He'll remind you, us, rather.
William wrapped his jacket around his sleeve and pushed aside some of the roof. The desks are still here.
Fire can be funny like that, said Goodmountain gloomily. And the roof probably kept the worst of it away.
I mean, they're half charred, but they're still usable.
Oh, well, we're home and dry then, said the dwarf, now sliding towards Glumley. How soon do you want the next edition?
Look, even the spike. There's even bits of paper that are hardly charred.
Life is full of unexpected treasure, said Goodmountain. I don't think you should come in here, miss.
This was to Saccharissa, who was picking her way across the smouldering ruins. It's where I work, she said. Can you repair the press?
No, it's done for. It's scrap. We've got no press and no type and no metal. Can you both hear me?
Okay, so we've got to get another press, said Saccharissa evenly.
Even an old scrap one would cost $1,000, said Goodmountain. Look, it's over. There is nothing left.
I've got some savings, said Saccharissa, pushing the rubble off her desk. Perhaps we could get one of those little hand presses to be going on with.
I'm in debt, said William, but I could probably go into debt for another few $100s.
Do you think we could go on working if we put a tarpaulin over the roof, or should we move to somewhere else? Said Saccharissa.
I don't want to move. A few days' work should get this place in shape, said William.
Goodmountain cupped his hands around his mouth.
Hello? This is sanity calling. We have no money.
There's not much room to expand, though, said Saccharissa.
In what way?
Magazines, said Saccharissa, as the sleet settled in her hair. Around her, the other dwarfs spread out on a hopeless salvage operation. Yes, I know the paper's important, but there's a lot of dead time on the press, and, well, I'm sure there'd be a market for something like, well, a magazine for ladies.
Dead time on the press, said Goodmountain. The press is dead.
What about? Said William, completely ignoring him. Oh, fashion. Pictures of women wearing new clothes, knitting, that sort of thing. And don't you go telling me it's too dull. People will buy it.
Clothes?
Knitting? People are interested in that sort of thing.
I don't like that idea much, said William. You might as well say we should have a magazine just for men.
Why not? What would you put in it?
Oh, I don't know. Articles about drink? Pictures of women not wearing... Anyway, we'd need more people to write for them. Excuse me, said Goodmountain.
Lots of people could write well enough for that sort of thing, said Saccharissa. If it was clever, we wouldn't be able to do it.
That's true.
And there's another magazine that would sell too, said Saccharissa. Behind her, a piece of the press collapsed.
Hello? Hello! I know my mouth is opening and shutting, said Goodmountain. Is any sound getting out?
Cats, said Saccharissa. Lots of people like cats. Pictures of cats, stories about cats. I've been thinking about it. It could be called Completely Cats.
To go with Completely Women and Completely Men. Completely Knitting. Completely Cake.
I had thought of calling it something like The Lady's Home Companion, said Saccharissa. But your title has got a certain ring, I must admit. Ring, yes. Now that's another thing. There's all the dwarfs in the city. We could produce a magazine for them. I mean, what's the modern dwarf wearing this season?
Chainmail and leather, said Goodmountain, suddenly perplexed. What are you talking about? It's always chainmail and leather.
Saccharissa ignored him. The two of them were in a world of their own, Goodmountain realised. It had nothing to do with the real one any more.
"Seems a bit of a waste, though," said William.
"A waste of words, I mean."
"Why? There's always more of them."
Saccharissa patted him gently on the cheek. "You think you're writing words that'll last forever. It's not like that. This newspaper stuff, that's words that last for a day, maybe a week."
"And then they get thrown away," said William.
"Perhaps a few hang on in people's heads?"
"That's not where the paper ends up," said William. "Quite the reverse."
"What did you expect? These aren't books. They're words that come and go. Cheer up."
"There's a problem," said William.
"Yes?"
"We haven't got enough money for a new press. Our shed has been burned down. We are out of business. It's all over. Do you understand?"
Saccharissa looked down. "Yes," she said meekly. "I just hoped you didn't."
"And we were so close, so close."
William pulled out his notebook.
"We could have run with this. I've got nearly the whole thing. All I can do with it now is give it to Vimes."
Where's the lead?
William looked across the wreckage. Bodney was crouching by the smoking press, trying to see under it.
There's not a sign of the lead, he said.
It's got to be somewhere, said Goodmountain. In my experience, 20 tons of lead does not just get up and walk away.
It must have melted, said Bodney.
There's a few blobs on the floor.
The cellar, said Goodmountain. Give me a hand here, will you?
He grabbed a blackened beam.
Here, I'll help, said William, coming round the stricken desk. It's not as though I've got anything better to do.
He got a grip on a tangle of charred wood and pulled.
Mr. Pin arose from the pit like a demon king. Smoke poured off him, and he was screaming one long, incoherent scream. He rose and rose and knocked Goodmountain aside with a round-arm sweep, and then his arms clamped around William's neck, and still his leap propelled him up. William fell backwards. He landed on the desk and felt a stab of pain as some piece of debris went through the flesh of his arm. But there was no time to think about pain that had happened. It was imminent pain that occupied all his future. The face of the creature was inches away, eyes wide and staring through him at something horrible, but his hands were tight around William's neck. William would never have dreamed of using a cliché as tired as vice-like grip, but as consciousness became a red-walled tunnel, the editor inside him said, yes, that's what it would be like, the sheer mechanical pressures that... The eyes crossed, the scream stopped, the man staggered sideways, half-crouched. As William raised his head, he saw Saccharissa stepping backwards. The editor chittered away in his head, watching him, watching her. She'd kicked the man in the... you know. It had to be the influence of those humorous vegetables. It had to be. And he had to get the story. William rose to his feet and waved frantically at the dwarfs, who were advancing with their axes at the ready. Wait, wait! And look, you, Brother Pin...
He winced at the pain in his arm, looked down and saw with horror the evil length of the spike poking through the cloth of his jacket. Mr. Pin tried to focus on the boy grappling with his arm, but the shadows wouldn't let him. He wasn't certain now that he was still alive.
Yes, that was it. He must be dead.
All this smoke, people shouting, all the voices whispering in his ear, this was some kind of hell, but, ha-ha, he had a return ticket. He managed to straighten up. He fished the potato of the late Mr. Tulip out of his shirt. He held it aloft.
Got my potato, he said proudly. More right, okay.
William stared at the smoke-stained, red-eyed face with its horrible expression of triumph, and then at the shrunken vegetable on the end of its string. His grip on reality was at the moment almost as slippery as Mr. Pin's, and people showing him a potato seemed to mean only one thing.
It's not a very funny one, is it? He said,
wincing as he tugged at the spike. Mr. Pin's last train of thought jumped the rails. He let go of the potato, and with a movement that owed nothing to thought and everything to instinct, pulled a long dagger from inside his jacket. The figure in front of him was fading into just another shadow, among many now, and he lunged madly. William pulled the metal free, and his hand flew out in front of him, and that, for the moment, was everything that Mr. Pin ever knew. The sleet hissed on a few remaining embers. William stared into the puzzled face as the light in the eyes went out, and the attacker sagged slowly to the ground, one hand fiercely hanging on to the potato.
"Oh," said Saccharissa distantly, "you spiked him."
Blood dripped down William's sleeve.
I think I could do with a bandage, he said.
Ice shouldn't be hot, he knew, but shock was filling his veins with a burning chill. He was sweating ice. Saccharissa ran forward, tearing at the sleeve of her blouse.
I don't think it's bad, said William, trying to back away. I just think it's one of those enthusiastic wounds.
What has been happening here?
William looked at the blood on his hand and then at Otto, standing on top of a pile of rubble, with an amazed look on his face and a couple of packages in his hands.
I just go away for 5 minutes to buy some more acids, and suddenly the whole place... Oh, dear, oh, dear.
Goodmountain pulled a tuning fork out of his pocket and twanged it on his helmet.
Quick, lads! He waved the fork in the air. Oh, will you come to the mission?
Otto waved his hand gently as the dwarfs began to sing.
No, I am well on top of it, thank you all the same, he said. We know what all this is about, don't we? It was a mob, yes? There is always a mob sooner or later. They got my friend Boris.
He showed them the black ribbon, but they just laughed and...
I think they were after all of us, said William. I wish I'd had a chance to ask him a few questions, even so.
You mean, like, is this the first time you've strangled anyone, said Botany, or how old are you, Mr. Killer?
Something started to cough. It seemed to be coming from the pocket of the man's jacket. William looked around at the stunned dwarfs to see if anyone else had a clue about what it was he should do next. Then he reluctantly patted the greasy suit with extreme care and pulled out a slim, polished box. He opened it. A small green imp peered out of its slot.
"Hm?"
it said.
"What?"
"A personal disorganizer," said William. "A killer with a personal disorganizer."
"The things to do today section is going to be interesting, then," said Botany.
The imp blinked at him.
"Do you want me to reply or not?"
it said.
"Insert name here, requested silence, despite my range of sounds, to suit any mood or occasion."
"Your previous owner is... previous," said William, looking down at the cooling Mr. Pin.
"You're a new owner," said the imp.
"Well, possibly."
"Congratulations," said the imp. "Warranty not applicable if said device is sold, hired, transferred, gifted or stolen, unless in original packaging and extraneous materials, which by then you will have thrown away, and part two of the warranty card which you have lost has been filled in and sent to scores and quoting the reference number, which you did not in fact make a note of. Do you want me to wipe the contents of my memory?"
It produced a cotton wool bud and prepared to insert it into one very large ear.
"Erase memory, Y, stroke N."
"Your memory?"
"Yes, erase memory, Y, stroke N."
"N," said William.
"And now, tell me what exactly it is you are remembering," he added. "You have to press the recall button," said the imp impatiently.
"And that will do what?"
"A small hammer hits me on the head, and I look to see what button you pressed."
"Why don't you just, well, recall?"
"Look, I don't make the rules. You've got to press the button. It's in the manual."
William carefully pushed the box to one side. There were several velvet bags in the dead man's pocket. He put these on the desk, too. Some of the dwarfs had gone a little way down the iron ladder into the cellar. Botany climbed back out again, looking thoughtful.
"There's a man down there," he said, "lying in... lead."
"Dead?" said William, looking carefully at the bags.
"I hope so. I really hope so. You could say he made a bit of an impression. He's a bit on the cooked side, and there's an arrow through his head."
"William, you realise that you are robbing a corpse," said Saccharissa.
"Good," said William distantly. "Best time."
He upended a bag and jewels spilled across the charred wood. There was a strangled noise from Good Mountain. Next to gold, jewels were a dwarf's best friend. William emptied the other bags.
"How much do you think this lot is worth?" he said, when the gems stopped rolling and twinkling.
Goodmountain had already whipped an eyeglass from an inside pocket and was inspecting a few of the larger stones.
"What? Eh? Oh, tens of thousands. Could be 100,000. Could be a lot more. This one here is worth 1,500, I reckon, and it's not the best of them."
"He must have stolen them," said Saccharissa.
"No," said William calmly. "We'd have heard about a theft this big. We hear about things. A young man would certainly have told you. Check to see if he has a wallet, will you?"
"The very idea. And what?"
"Check for a damn wallet, will you?" said William.
"This is a story. I'm going to check his legs, and I'm not looking forward to that either. But this is a story. We can have hysterics later. Do it, please."